Welcome back to the Voices from the Frontline segment of the Public Affairs Hour. Let's hope that the jail cells get empty. And we got two people on the line right now that are trying to make that happen. So we have Kim McGill, who is from the Youth Justice Coalition, who has been dealing with Chief Braddon on the East and West Coast. And then Guillermo Suarez from the People's Commission in Defense of Human Rights. Both of you, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon.
So I guess just to start this in context, and I think a lot of times this whole stuff around the May Day police brutality is kind of taken as an individual act and not put in the context. I think I want to just talk about Police Chief Braddon, because right now he's kind of in this limbo area. The day before May 1st, he had a public hearing for his continuation, his reappointment to another five-year term on as a police chief, which at that point, it seemed like it was like, you know, cake for him. Everybody was like, I love Braddon and don't take him away from us, et cetera, et cetera. The next day, you know, shots fired, people getting beat down and et cetera. So I guess let's talk about the first thing. We'll start with Kim first. Do you think that Braddon should be fired or asked not to have a second term, and then why?
Well, we actually felt like it was really wrong to appoint him the first time. We felt that for a number of reasons. One is that his record in New York was to dismantle community policing, to be not only uncaring when there was overuse of excessive force by the NYPD and the killing of unarmed people, but to also be callous in his criticism of families and his total defense of officers. He does occasionally discipline officers, but it usually, to me or to all of us that were doing the work in New York, felt like it was scapegoating of individual officers so as not to hold the department accountable and really change policy. He also practiced that broken window style of policing. Not that it wasn't something that was being pushed nationwide. I'm not pretending that he invented it, but he has probably been most successful in implementing it. And so his implementation of that in New York meant that the constant use of stop and frisk tactics, which he's also used in L.A., really just puts thousands of primarily young men of color into the system. When he started using that policy in New York, the only significant increase in arrests that went up in his first 6 to 7 months was for truancy, and they only found a few guns in more than, I think it was 60,000 stops, stop and frisks. So it's a very expensive style of policing. He gets a lot of support for it, but in reality, it makes our communities a lot less safe and really deteriorates police-youth relations and police-community relations.
Well, that's interesting, the whole piece around truancy. We'll get into Rocky Delgadillo later, who is pushing for tougher penalties on truancy, et cetera. But Guillermo, just on the same kind of line of questioning, you know, there's been this whole thing talking about how the officers that he demoted that were, you know, high up there in command on May 1st were just seen as sacrificial lambs. I think another line that I've been trying to figure out in terms of if, and again, I think that he should not be police chief. I think he should not only not have his term extended, I think that the police commission should ask him to step down. But in terms of that, if Braddon was gone, would that also not be type of sacrificial lamb and leaving kind of the institutional racism that is just flowing in the veins of the LAPD almost untouched?
I would tend to agree with you. And I think that we, as the People's Commission in Defense of Human Rights, we would also demand that, you know, he not be reappointed to a new contract. But as you say, we have to go back and really look at and understand what is the role of police. They're nothing but fancy slave catchers, you know. And if we look at their history, where they come from, we'll see that that's the role that police play in our communities, particularly Black, Mexican, and Latino, you know, communities, Asian communities as well. That's the role of the police in our communities, is to keep us oppressed, to keep us down. And eliminating one or two people at the top isn't, in essence, changing the basic nature of what the police are. I mean, because when we were in the park in MacArthur Park, this May 1st, it reminded us of August 29, 1970, when again, the L.A. sheriffs, you know, attacked a peaceful crowd that was protesting the war in Vietnam at that time. And there were three deaths and, you know, countless arrests and numbers of people that were injured. So, and then there was the whole question of Eula Love and Devon Brown and the Susy Peña, right? There's a whole series of cases of police brutality that are going unanswered. So we think that beyond just requesting the removal of the police chief, We want the police to be accountable to local communities. We want an independent citizen review panel, one that's elected by the community, not appointed by the mayor or the police commission. An entity that would be responsible to the community for investigating, you know, the police abuse. And we believe that the community should control the police, and we think that consistent with the settlement that was reached in the DNC cases, that we don't need the TAC squad or the Metro squad out to peaceful demonstrations of the kind that took place on May 1st. We think that there should be basically traffic police, people just, you know, police out there to stop traffic, to close off streets, but we don't need the tactical squad out there. We can police ourselves, you know, and so this is part of a developing movement for local autonomy and local control by specific communities of our lives, and that's the whole question. It's a question of self-determination for our peoples, for all peoples.
Me and Damon, again, we were in this ride from the office to here. Just we're talking about where we're at in the movement at this moment, because I think, you know, I think for, I would say for all three of us, I guess, myself and Damon and you two out there, we still represent a certain void. We represent a certain tendency in the movement. But in many ways, the movement hasn't really addressed that. In many ways, we're a split movement, where I think at this moment in history, most movements, most social groups are trying to, because the system is so messed up right now, are taking on some very important issues, from immigration to housing to education. And yet, in many ways, at the end of the day, we don't really touch the issue of policing and the impact it has, just like we had, you know, the speaker, the former person on John Lund, who was talking to us about, you know, the state is now going to increase the number of beds by 53,000 people. I mean, 53,000 people, which includes 53,000 beds. Where do you guys measure our ability to address this question around the police, and where do you think given that I feel like every 5 years, even if we don't want to touch the police, the police comes and touch us and beat us down, and there's a big militant, you know, conversation about you know, what police tactics should be and what's the role of police. But then it dies down and we go back to sort of the day-to-day work.
I think for us, while we're not glad that May 1st happened, it does have a uniting force in L.A. that's very positive for the movement. And I say that because I think that some of us that have been doing police accountability, prison abolition work for a while, have had a hard time getting other social activists, social movements to buy into the fact that defending the rights of young people that are alleged gang members on the gang file, mm-hmm. for example, or defending the rights of families whose children are killed by the police, like Devin Brown or Susie Pena, or defending the rights of undocumented workers, or even what's harder, the rights of aggregated felonies, people with aggregated felonies that are facing deportation, to defend the rights of the larger immigration movement to take those people in under their wing. That's been very hard for us until May 1st. And I think when events like May 1st happen, as bad as they are, it wakes people up to the fact that if you don't defend the rights of every single person, then eventually those tactics that are used against the people that are most marginalized are going to come back to be used against you. And I think we've learned that lesson. Of course, nobody needs to hear it. Everybody knows that. But for whatever reason, we kind of have to see it every few years. And it's, I think if L.A., you know, more than any other place in the country, maybe one of the most significant histories in the world, has had so-called riots throughout its history, and all of them have either been in response to police brutality and misconduct or led by rogue police, rogue marshals. And, you know, before we had a police department, it was led by rogue marshals. Mm-hmm. So we can go all the way back to the 1800s and see that pattern in the policing in L.A. And days like May 1st bring everybody in L.A., kind of wake up everybody to the fact that police brutality and misconduct and the militarization of a police state affects everybody in every single movement.
Guillermo, would you agree? You know, one of the things that we, you know, ourselves with, you know, YJC and many groups have, you know, been attacking the concept, the expansion of more police. And, you know, and every time we talk to a lot of Latino elected officials in particular, they say, hey, it's the black community who's really against the black, you know, is against the police. the Latino community in many ways, you know, sort of likes police. Do you think in many ways we've lost the tradition of really challenging the real role of police in our community?
I would tend to agree, but I think also that elected politicians of whatever stripe, mm-hmm. whatever color, aren't going to be the answer. Mm-hmm. I mean, aren't the elected colored people now pushing to have 1,000 more cops mm-hmm. at the expense of the bus riders? You know, and I don't think 1,000 more cops is a solution. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that it is true that while many of us have protested and complained about the militarization of society and increasing police repression, it's almost as if it's an afterthought, as if it's not something that's like on the front burner. It's not something that the rest of the left is really addressing, because many of us put it forth in the context of self-determination mm-hmm. in terms of viewing the police as occupying armies in our communities, and other sectors of the left don't really share that perspective or that understanding, and so they don't necessarily do the work against police abuse. And as long as the police are here to protect and to serve the interests of the oppressive class, there's going to be police repression. There will be police brutality, because we are going to continue to organize to open up to democratize society, and they're going to see it as a challenge to their interests. They're going to see it as a challenge to their privilege, and they're not going to be about tolerating that. But let me just, you know, move it a little bit. Is the other day I was talking to someone, and they were telling me how Police Chief Bratton, before he came to Los Angeles, had gone to Venezuela to train the police in Venezuela. Mm-hmm. Before that, and after that, he'd gone to Mexico City mm-hmm. to train the police in Mexico City. And isn't it coincidental that on May 1st, Villaraigosa was in El Salvador, supposedly to sign some new international treaties regarding police training and the sharing of information and tactics vis-a-vis what they call, you know, the maras, the local gangs. Mm-hmm. So we see that the state terror, right, police terrorism, is being coordinated from the United States. And this police repression is taking place in different countries throughout our America, led by the United States of America. So I think that people need to open up their eyes and view, you know, police repression as an instrument to keep people under control. It isn't just these isolated events that happen once every 5 years or once every 6 months, or, oh, it was just another kid who was shot, or, yeah, he came at us with a broomstick, or he did that, or he was holding up his wallet, remember? Mm-hmm. He was holding up his wallet, and we thought it was a gun, so we had to really, like, mow him down. Or the brother was shot down in Norwalk with a machine gun, and the cop, you know, the Norwalk police just opened fire on him. Gonzalo Martinez, I believe, is the young mm-hmm. man's name.
That's right.
You know? And so those are things that we have to look at in the bigger picture and put them into context.
And do you think on some ways what Kim was saying is earlier is that it's true that sort of when it hits us in the head, and one of the things that we've been at least trying to argue with a lot of our, you know, a lot of our comrades, a lot of the folks that we know, so, you know, just so we don't, it's not a weird conversation, we're all talking to each other in some ways, but, you know, one of the things that we have been very critical about the question around immigration right now is that we're very, very silent about the use of police for enforcement of immigration, or at the same time that there's a conversation about some kind of comprehensive reform, in many ways, as I was talking to Nativo Lopez, that in some ways the Democrats are telling people be silent on the question around the raids and how many people are being picked up, because if we might be able to win reform on the other end. And yet, again, it sort of like hit us right in the face on May 1st, where we saw the real tactics and views of what the police really was going to do to our community.
I think that it's important when we look at Bratton or any other, I would say, significant policymaker worldwide in terms of policing and how it's carried out, is to also start to expose each of the tactics that they really promote. Because, again, when something like what happened in May 1st comes up, they tend to hold up individual officers as at fault, like somehow they didn't follow policy, when in fact it's the very policies that Bratton and other chiefs like him promote that created a May 1st. So using that kind of heavy-handed, again, military-style riot police in riot gear is a type of policing that Bratton has pushed and has trained departments on. And definitely in New York, we saw a real difference in how civil disobedience or even much less confrontational protests were handled by him than in prior chiefs, or prior, in that case, police commissioners. So I think there's like some things that we should really start to expose in terms of how he does policing and how he is training people throughout Central America, Latin America, and getting huge consulting contracts to do it. One I mentioned earlier is this issue of broken windows policing, but why that's important is a greater criminalization of people for low-level offenses that in the past they've never been criminalized for. So it sweeps many more people into the jails. And then you can argue, because you're doing mass arrests and mass incarceration, that you need, in fact, more police and more jail cells. So it also allows for you to fundraise a lot more for your department. The second is displacement. The use of policing to support gentrification, deportation, and again, mass incarceration, particularly in communities where you're looking to displace people so that luxury development can happen. So we could see that throughout the city, but most notably in Skid Row, and not surprisingly, that's the only majority black community left in LA. So I think that race is always obviously attached to that. The third tactic Bratton loves is the use of surveillance. And it's kind of gone about, unreported on, but we now have the most technologically advanced surveillance system that's been put into Jordan Downs Housing Development in Watts, and another one that's going into Imperial Courts in the Southeast Division. And we've toured it, and it's pretty shocking what it's capable of doing. It's like a $1.5 million project, a lot funded by Motorola, and it's the first time in the country where you're going to be having Motorola wireless tracking of people in residences. And basically, from either a police car or a police station, you can move cameras so that you don't even just have cameras that are stationary, but which, like, if someone went around the corner, you can move the camera to follow them around the corner. And it's monitored from the police department as well as from local police cars, so that the police department, who's monitoring it there, can signal to the police cars, you know, go to this, look on this camera only, and go to this location. The use of international and more sophisticated IDs is something that Bratton promotes, and as part of that surveillance, too, the use of databases. So when we initially met with him around changes in the gang database and how we want to dismantle the gang database, but we were in the meantime asking for right to notification, right to appeal, he didn't follow up on any of those things, and it's been real clear to us that he supports that kind of surveillance of people, of civilians. The fourth thing that he really promotes, both in New York and here, is not only the use of excessive force, like what we saw on May 1st, but the total defense of it when it happens. So, like, for example, when the shooting of Devin Brown came down, his immediate defense of the officer involved, and when they came down with their own investigation that the shooting had actually happened from the side of the car and not from behind the car, then again attacking the family for, like, why was a 13-year-old out in the street? We've seen him do this again and again. Susie Pena, same thing, attack the father, you know, exaggerate or lie in many cases, like he did when he lied about the fact that the father was using Susie Pena as a shield when clearly the child was not being used as a shield. So that's another way of this upholding of excessive force. The next is use of military tactics and military technology on communities. And Bratton, both in New York and here, has practiced that kind of maneuver, like what you saw on May 1st, has practiced it in urban settings in the U.S., and then taken those kind of tactics into so-called, how they would define it, guerrilla settings in other parts of the world. So if you're waging war in L.A. and you're using it kind of as a practice place, then you can use those same tactics, and they regularly share what they've learned with the military and with other, I guess you could say, death squads in Central America, in Iraq, et cetera.
Yeah, I think that's really important. If we just bring back to the, you know, the first question I was asking about, you know, if Bratton was fired or asked to step down or whatever, what would that kind of victory be? And I think the whole idea of him promoting this whole type of American, if I dare say, broken Williams theory of policing that is being exported all over the world, to actually have him as kind of like the head mouthpiece of that, to actually lose his position, would then, I hope, and feel that would actually damage some of the credibility of the broken windows theory of policing.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. The last thing I would just say that's a big part of that theory, because I think it touches so many people in L.A. too, is the promotion of zero tolerance in schools. And when Bratton was in New York, he was the first person to really promote the police takeover of school security. And when he came to L.A., because we have the police run school security here, he's really exploited that to have total connection and coordination between school police and LAPD, including the lockdown of schools, sweeps in schools, surveillance of schools, et cetera.
I would basically agree. You know, I think that if he's not renewed, if he's not given a renewal in his contract, then that would be a step in the right direction, and it would also be a way to show to the community, you know, if it is as a result of community pressure and community organizing, that the community is empowered and the community can make certain changes. But it's not, you know, just bad apples. It's the whole system of the police themselves. That's why we in defense of human rights, we believe that we need to have a complete overhaul in terms of what the police do, how they function in society, and how they function particularly in our communities. And that's why we believe that we need to establish community control of the police. Without that, or even different alternative models of policing, as they're doing now in, say, the liberated zones in Guerrero and in Chiapas, where, I mean, given that they're different situations, but still, they're coming up with new alternatives in terms of what the police force is supposed to represent and how you have a different police structure. Because I wanted to go back and say that there are also cameras. I read it somewhere, and then I haven't picked it up since then, but that there are cameras in MacArthur Park that the police are supposedly looking at the videos or whatever they took from those to see what happened. I mean, as if people don't know what happened in terms of the police terrorism, the police riot that took place in the park. But going back to the immigration question, part of this whole discussion around comprehensive immigration reform includes more militarization, includes, if you will, steps towards a national identification card, a passbook, if you will, that's something that all of us are going to have to start carrying in order to identify ourselves. The other step that we need to look at is to say that in a year from now, anyone who travels outside the United States and is going to return needs a U.S. passport. So it's like they're already setting up this passbook situation slowly, step by step, and the rest of us are out here just sort of not being aware of it.
And at the same time, targeting the people who are the most disenfranchised first. So once they get into place, practice it out, then when it gets expanded to other people, then it's kind of almost like a surprise to them.
That's exactly right.
So we're just, for the listeners out there, you should start calling in 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. With the last, you say, 30 seconds each, we'd like to thank our guests and have them give some contact information. So, Kim, if you can give some of YJZ's information.
Sure. You can reach us at 323-235-4243. By email, you can reach us at freelanow@yahoo.com. Our blog is at Youth for Justice. That's a youth4justice.org. And you can reach us at MySpace at FreeLA.
And I would say definitely anybody who is interested in these kind of issues, whether it's gang, database, injunction, policing, you got to get this blog because they break down history from like 1890s on down around immigration stuff. It's really, really good. So, Guillermo, where's your contact information?
My phone number you could call is 323-722-6100. And we're working on some web pages and email addresses at this time. I don't have anything to give out right now. Okay.
So we want to thank Kim McGill from YJC, Youth Justice Coalition, and Guillermo Suarez from the People's Network for the Defense of Human Rights. Thank you for joining us on the show.
Thank you.
See you out in the streets.
All right.
And for our listeners, again, we're going to have a short break. 818-985-5735, 818-985-5735. And we're wanting calls on the stuff we were talking today around, if you were there on May 1st, we want you to call, give us a short comment on it, as well as stuff around the prison. So we'll be right back.